You're listening to The Point. In 1943, Elie Wiesel was 15 years old. He and his family were deported from their home in Transylvania to Auschwitz by the Nazis. He lost his mother, father, and a sister in the prison camps, and he wrote about his experience in the death camps in his memoir, Night. In addition to being an author and a professor, Wiesel was a lifelong activist for human rights and was awarded a Nobel Peace Prize in 1986. But when asked, Elie Wiesel always said, "I am a teacher." Rabbi Ariel Berger was Elie Wiesel's teaching assistant for 5 years, and his new book, Witness, Lessons from Elie Wiesel's Classroom, allows readers a glimpse into the lessons, discussions, and stories of Professor Wiesel. So, Rabbi Berger, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, he died in 2016, and when that happened, the world lost a generous, wise man who urged us to be better and to do better. You lost a teacher, a mentor, and a friend. Can you describe what he was like in person?
Yeah, he was a person with great emotional range. He had a presence about him that's hard to put into words, but a lot of people reported that they felt a certain kind of peacefulness in his presence. He had an incredible sense of humor, which if you read Night, you wouldn't necessarily expect. And knowing his early experiences of the Holocaust, you would think this would be a very depressed person. But he was funny, playful, immensely curious, a voracious learner and reader. And when you sat with him, he was interested only in you. Mm. He had full attention on you.
It's funny how you describe him. I'm looking at the picture on the cover of the book, and I thought about that, just looking at his photo. There is this kind of peacefulness to his face, but I don't know, something in the eyes, right? I never met him, obviously, but something in the eyes that just, I don't know, speaks wisdom or something.
Yeah, I love that photo so much, and it really captures what it felt like to sit with him in his office and sort of be in a long personal conversation.
Yeah. So your book focuses on his teachings. He was a professor at BU for nearly four decades. What was the subject he taught, and what were the goals as a teacher?
Well, his course was always titled Literature of Memory, colon, something else, a specific title. And he taught two classes, one on Monday, one on Tuesday in the fall semester. The Monday class was usually a general topic in literature or philosophy, something like faith and heresy, or literary responses to oppression, or hidden and banned books, or authors of exile and memory, big topics like that. And then the Tuesday class was usually a biblical text or other Jewish traditional text. And the course was composed of, the course readings were composed of and consisted of books from classical and modern literature, a great diversity of texts. And he never taught the same class twice.
Oh, wow.
So over 40 years, or almost 40 years, he always wanted to be learning and expanding.
Right, and that's storytelling. So he used storytelling, parables, passages from great books of literature and philosophy to help students unravel some of the issues and complexities that we face in day-to-day life. So why do you think storytelling is such a powerful educational tool?
Well, first of all, it's hard to argue with a story, right? Like you can argue with a political position or statement. You can learn from and open up to a story, and it can resonate with your own story. So the dialogue between your life and what's written in the text or the story that we're studying in class happens very organically. And so when he shared a story from the Bible or Kafka or Shakespeare, students naturally and immediately identified with something in the story, were inspired, or something resonated, or something disturbed them about the story, and it created dialogue. And his goal as a teacher was really to create dialogue with his students and between and among his students.
You mentioned the class was memory, something, something, something. You want to read a little bit from the book?
Sure. So this is from the first chapter, and it's a classroom scene that takes place in the very first class meeting. And it begins with a very short text that Professor Wiesel handed out to students. And so this begins with a short story by a great Hasidic master named Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. And the story is called The Tainted Grain. Once an astrologer king saw in the stars that anyone who would eat of the coming harvest would go mad. He called in his viceroy and friend to ask for his advice. "Sire," replied the counselor, "I know what to do. You and I shall eat only last year's harvest, which is untainted, and so we shall remain sane." But the king replied, "I do not accept your proposal. How can we separate ourselves from our people? To remain the only sane people among a nation of madmen, they will think we are the ones who are mad. Instead, you and I shall eat of the tainted grain and shall enter into madness with our people." The king thought for a moment, then said, "We must, however, at least recognize our malady. Therefore, you and I shall mark each other's foreheads with a sign, and every time we look at one another, we shall remember that we are mad." Professor Wiesel looks around at his students and says, "So, what do we make of this story?" There is a long moment of silence, which is typical for the very first classroom moments, and the silence expands to fill the high-ceilinged room. But he is comfortable with silence. He waits, and after several seconds, two students raise their hands, and Professor Wiesel nods at the first. A young woman with large, bright red glasses says, "If the world is mad..." "Please say your name," interrupts Professor Wiesel. "Oh, I'm Karen, and I'm from Chicago," she says, only slightly flustered. "If the world is mad, with whatever kind of madness, bad behavior, or just distorted ways of looking at things, then leaders have to stay close to the people to have a chance of helping." "Good. I need more," says Professor Wiesel, and he looks to the next student whose hand is raised. Sole, an African theology student, introduces herself and says, "I have seen this kind of thing before, when real madness sweeps a nation and the leaders hide behind their fortified walls. They refuse to come out, they do not take responsibility, and people are hurt. But when the leaders go with the people, sometimes things have changed." I see Professor Wiesel's gaze sharpen. "Where are you from?" he asks. Soleil says, "I am from Zimbabwe." "Then you understand this story," he says, "and you must share your story." Later, Soleil comes to talk to me during office hours. She explains haltingly that her brother was killed by the Mugabe regime during a protest. "I'm so sorry, I can't imagine that," I tell her. Then after a moment, I tell her, "You know that Professor Wiesel meets with every student in this class, but he will especially want to speak with you. I can help you make an appointment with him for next week if you'd like." She agrees, and I see her smile for the first time. Later, she told me she met with him for almost an hour. She discussed her experiences with him, he asked questions, and they sat in silence for several minutes. At the end, as Soleil stood in the open doorway about to leave, Professor Wiesel took her hand gently and said, "I told you in class that you must tell your story. This is because if even one person learns from it how to be more human, you will have made your memories into a blessing. We must turn our suffering into a bridge so that others might suffer less."
Mm-hmm. Sounds like such a wonderful teacher.
Yeah.
So moral education is often taught at university or in churches and synagogues, but there are many who will never cross the thresholds of those institutions. And there are many people who don't have the time nor the opportunity to dig deeper, read deeper, think deeper. How do we address this disparity and create opportunities for everyone?
Well, I think about this a lot, and I think it's a really important question in a world where our moral compass is often very fuzzy. It's confusing and overwhelming. And we have a lot of questions about what is the extent of our obligation to others in our neighborhoods and on the other side of the world. And so I think we have to find ways to publicize and popularize moral education and moral conversations. And for Elie Wiesel, it started with questions. It didn't start with positing answers. It really started with questions and generating the questions that we live with, the questions that can help us begin to clarify our positions and begin, more importantly, to create dialogue with others with whom we might disagree. Mm-hmm. But in that dialogue and in the space between us, as an old teaching has it, worlds can be created. We don't have to agree with one another, but being in dialogue and asking questions together is an act of tremendous blessing and redemption and potential. So in terms of the delivery system for that, you know, I imagine public salons, and I imagine programs in public libraries and cafes. I imagine films and discussion groups around those films. I wrote the book in part to be a small vehicle for that kind of conversation. And I think there's a lot more we need to do as a society.
Given the pervasiveness of technology in our lives and the speed to which we've grown accustomed to getting and communicating information, what gives you hope that given a chance, people will take a moment to think a little bit deeper about issues and, as you say, have these conversations?
Well, I think we're faced with a challenge of hope. And, you know, the world is struggling with so many real issues. I don't have to tell you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we could just list those issues for a long time. And there are a lot of challenges. And so a lot of people I'm meeting on this book tour are overwhelmed, are wrestling with despair. And what Elie Wiesel taught was that we need to choose hope. And by hope, he did not mean a kind of passive hope waiting for things to get better. He meant a very muscular, active hope, which gets us off the couch and gets us to start doing something positive. And the two challenges to that hope, I think, are number one, complacency and just not looking at what's happening in the world. And the second is when we start looking at what's happening in the world, it's very easy to feel despair. Mm. And so how do we avoid those two challenges of complacency and despair? I think we do that together. I think we do that by creating small communities and taking one or two or three small actions every day to make things better, whether it's washing the dishes in the house when, you know, the dishes aren't getting done, or calling a senator or congressman, or choosing to look at what's happening in Yemen or Syria or other places in the world where people are suffering in order to awaken yourself and sensitize yourself. And so I think technology is challenging, but what gives me hope is, number one, that technology also brings us closer together. We really can't say that we don't know what's happening mm-hmm. on the other side of the world anymore. If you have Facebook or Instagram or Snapchat or any social media, we know what's happening, and that creates a moral obligation. And that's uncomfortable,
right?
But it also creates the possibility that maybe we'll do something more to help. And number two, we all know, I think, that for the sake of our own mental health and well-being, we need to take time away from technology. We need to be in conversation with other people in real time. We need to read books. And that's good for us and it's good for the world. So I think there's a way that those things come together.
In the book, you write, like propaganda, its evil twin, moral education is contagious. And to be effective, it must be contagious. Unlike propaganda, through which tells people what they want to hear or feeds their existing fears, moral education tells people what they need to hear, even when it's painful. Kind of what you're saying here. It's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Elie Wiesel said once that you can tell the difference between a false prophet and a true prophet because false prophets comfort and true prophets disturb. Mm. So one way to notice how I'm doing in terms of my moral well-being is, am I so comfortable that I'm complacent? On the other hand, if I'm too disturbed that I'm frozen or I despair, that doesn't help anyone. So really finding that balance.
Yeah. Wiesel, perhaps because of his history and simply due to his nature, had a gift of leading in moral education. What can we take away from his example? And are there times when a more strident or stronger voice is needed?
Well, he wrestled all the time with heads of state, with other human beings, with God. I mean, he took on major challenges and he never rested in that sense. But he was also a person of great restfulness and peacefulness. So he said two things. In class once he said, "I don't understand the American phrase, relax." How can you relax when you know what's happening in the world? But when I once asked him if there was anything I could do for him, he said, "Just be." So there's a combination there of urgency and calm that I think is really helpful for us as we're thinking about how to make a difference in the world. And he also pointed our attention to what's happening right now. I mean, Elie Wiesel was someone who traveled to Cambodia, Yugoslavia, was involved in genocide prevention efforts in Rwanda and Darfur and elsewhere. And I don't think he had an expectation that all of us would travel around the world doing international activism, although I hope some of us will. But he wanted his students and people in general to, as he said, look for the outstretched hand. Look for someone in your vicinity who needs a smile or an expression of love or support. And those acts, those small, modest acts, really add up. They really make a difference.
They do. There's concern that we're seeing a shift in social norms, that respect, decency, and kindness are giving way to name-calling, moral compromise, and corruption. We've seen an increase in hate crimes, targeting killings of African Americans and Jews in houses of worship. People are outraged. People are also fearful and divided. So what lessons from Elie Wiesel stand out to you at these moments?
Three things. Number one, when you see the early signs of hatred, fight it right away. Don't wait. He said hatred is like a cancer and waiting doesn't help. And we've seen signs of hatred in words even before there were actions and deeds. So we can't hesitate. Number two, we have to balance the particularity of the victims and honoring the stories of each particular group that's been targeted with the universal lessons and implications. So, you know, I don't like it when people report on hate crimes and don't mention the religious background or the ethnicity of the victims, because the victims and their families care about their identities, right? Those are important to honor and value. And after the Tree of Life shooting in Pittsburgh, I saw reports that didn't mention Judaism, anti-Semitism, synagogue. I think that was motivated by various political impulses on the right and the left. And it's important to honor their particularity. And at the same time, to recognize that a hate crime is a hate crime and hate is hate. And we have to create friendships and connections across our communities and across differences. So in my Jewish community, I actually at a certain point had to say, let's not forget that within a couple of days of that event at Tree of Life Synagogue, two African Americans were killed in Kentucky, Maurice Stallard and Vicki Lee Jones, in a grocery store. And that was also clearly a hate crime. Let's not be blinded by our particularity to the suffering of others. Let's remember each other. Let's hold together. And the third thing is, don't allow these moments to overwhelm us to the point that we freeze up. Find something to do. Find five things to do a day. And they can be small things, but keep the forward motion.
In the book, you write about the profound influence your elementary school teachers had on you, and of course, the influence of the teachings of Elie Wiesel. We can find teachers and be teachers in many settings and circumstances. I guess it's a matter of being open in that moment. So what's your advice on when and how we learn and teach one another?
Well, we should always be learning, and I'm not sure we should always be teaching. I think we should always be listening and curious and cultivate our curiosity. I think it's one of the greatest things we can do for ourselves and for our children, people around us. And Elie Wiesel said that in class often. He said, I'm the best student in this class. He felt like a learner, a lifelong learner. He also said that teaching is the most glorious, honorable profession. And that's not always reflected in salaries, but it's something that we need to take seriously. My parents are both teachers, and you know, I think it's the most glorious thing you can do. So if you're actually teaching in a school, first of all, just know that Elie Wiesel would have stood up for you when you walked in the room. He would have honored you very deeply. And I think the opportunity to teach and to learn is really an opportunity to create friendships. That was something that he really emphasized. It's about the relationships as much as it is about the information or the knowledge.
I think you made a good point about his comment about he's the best student in the room, because if you ask any teacher, they'll tell you how much they continually learn from their students.
Yeah.
So great, another great observation. We will have a link to the book, Witness Lessons from Elie Wiesel's Classroom. Rabbi Ariel Berger, thanks so much for being here and sharing his lessons with us.
Thank you so much.
Coming up after a break, the Grammy-nominated vocal ensemble Skylark.